from 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org. I'm Steve Scheer. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. Joni Balter is with us from the Seattle Times. Hi,
good
Joni.
Morning. Hi. Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you.
Missed you a ton.
Where was I?
Where were you?
Forgetting the rules of radio. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Knut Berger is at crosscut.com. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Steve.
It's fine to be back in the chair with you folks. And I'm glad to say it's fine to tell you that the government is partially shut down in case you need any services. I hope you don't. Especially perhaps, don't eat tainted meat. Perhaps you shouldn't do that anyways.
But how would you know?
How would
you
know?
If you didn't have a meat inspector.
Don't need the NTSB to come investigate your accidents, and don't hope the FCC is paying attention to things.
That's a little close, but
we thought we'd just remind folks. So what do we have? We had some government shutdowns in the past, but they didn't really last very long. And then we had the big one in 95. We all remember that. That was a lot of fun. And we're going to talk about how this one relates to it. But here's a couple of clips. Here's John Boehner. Well, first, here's President Obama. He was talking yesterday in Rockville, Maryland.
The only thing that is keeping the government shut down, the only thing preventing people from going back to work and basic research starting back up and farmers and small business owners getting their loans, the only thing that's preventing all that from happening right now, today, in the next 5 minutes, is that Speaker John Boehner won't even let the bill get a yes or no vote, because he doesn't want to anger the extremists in his party.
Just in case you are unsure of where the president is pointing the finger. Now here's John Boehner, Speaker of the House, this morning in Washington, D.C.
I was at the White House the other night and listened to the president some 20 times explain to me why he wasn't going to negotiate. Sat there and listened to the majority leader in the United States Senate describe to me that he's not going to talk until we surrender. And then this morning, I get the Wall Street Journal out, and it says, well, we don't care how long this lasts because we're winning. Now, this isn't some damn game. The American people don't want their government shut down, and neither do I.
John Boehner says we're winning, quoting the Wall Street Journal. He's talking about the Republicans, Republican Party. Is that what he means by that?
No, it sounded like he meant the Democrats were winning.
Oh.
And there's been several polls on this. And 72% in many of the polls, I also saw one that said 78% of the American public, does not want the government shut down. A lot of those people don't like Obamacare, which is what this fight is about, but they don't like the tactics. So there was this senator, a Republican senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, who said the Republicans have found the one gambit that the American public likes even less than Obamacare, and it's this shutdown. He's a Republican from Arizona.
And what Boehner was trying to do in that soundbite there was flip the script and say it's the Democrats' fault that the shutdown is happening, which is contrary to all available facts. I mean, what Obama said at his Rockland speech is true. There is a majority right now in the House of Representatives for passing a spending bill or an authorization that will end the shutdown. There's a bipartisan majority. There are Republicans who want this over, and there are Democrats who obviously want this over, and there are enough of them to end it. But John Boehner won't bring that vote forward because the Tea Party caucus doesn't want him to. So it's impossible for me to understand how it could be someone's fault other than John Boehner and the people who he's listening to that this continues.
Yeah, just to clarify, you're right, of course. The Wall Street Journal was quoting a senior administration official said, we're winning.
If Boehner doesn't like that terminology, he ought to talk with Rand Paul, who was caught on a live mic yesterday saying we're going to win. It is politics. Everybody knows it. The only thing truthful, perhaps, in what John Boehner said there was that he doesn't want a government shutdown. I think he had argued against it within the caucus. But, I mean, he's an angry guy because he's impotent in terms of controlling his own congressional caucus. Everybody knows that if a funding bill went before the House, it would pass. The votes are there to pass it. The only reason it's not being put before the House is Boehner won't let it. And he won't let it because he himself is held hostage to this group of conservative Tea Party types. And, you know, the whole media coverage of this thing trying to either place equal responsibility, oh, the two sides aren't talking. You know, nobody says that in a hostage crisis. Nobody says, well, the two sides aren't talking. you know, it's that, you know, what's happening here is, I think, something really outrageous, really incredibly irresponsible. It's going to get worse. And a lot of stuff is going to get broken before whatever this is gets resolved.
Well, one thing you can tell is that folks are starting to talk endgame. In other words, the fatigue is on the one side where they're trying to say, and one of the most interesting mentions of this came from Indiana GOP Rep. Marlon Stutzman, who said, you know, after all this, I want to get something out of this. But then he said, I don't even know what that is. And so you can tell the Democrats are a little gleeful. I was surprised to see our very own Senator Patty Murray said, well, I don't know what he wants, but I'd be in on the group hug.
There you see their strategy in a nutshell. Do something crazy, grind everything to a halt, and then say, hey, you got to give us something so that we can save face and back down from this thing that we kind of realize is a dead end. And so he doesn't know what it is, but he wants something. And what Obama
has been
saying.
Do you think that's the actual strategy that from the Republicans? They expect they'll get something out of this that will help them save face but will appeal to the their base?
Sometimes I think we're looking for a rational strategy inside an event that has no rational strategy. But if there is any rationality to it, yeah, I think that might be one explanation, that they think they can essentially take a hostage, since we were talking about hostages, hold the government hostage and say, you know, you got to give us something. We don't know what it is, but just give us something so that we can release it, because we don't want to do this either. And I think that the Democrats are right to say, no, we're not negotiating. And they're right to say that they're winning. You see the Republican majority cracking right now. You see Republicans in Congress yelling at their leaders and saying, you know, what is the end game? Why are you doing this? This is bad for Republicans in moderate districts, like Republican Dave Reichert, who endorsed this shutdown, but now is trying to suggest that he's maybe not as for it as he was when he voted for it. And you also see John Boehner himself saying he's taking off the table the notion of letting the United States go into default by not raising the debt ceiling. That was really the only major leverage that they had left, that they were going to do something even crazier and send the United States into default by not opening up the government and raising the debt ceiling before October 17th. So now that Boehner has given up on that, I am not sure what reason the Democrats have to negotiate with them.
You know, on that debt ceiling, just very quickly, do the three of you take Boehner at his word that the fear was just the prelude to a bigger crisis?
Well, I take him at his word because of the way that the Wall Street folks are talking. They are leaning on him right now to end the shutdown, but they are really leaning on him, extra leaning, about the idea that this shutdown would then be followed by another closure of some sort that really, really wrecks the credibility of the United States government and plays havoc with the economy. There are, you know, you've heard all the numbers. You've heard people talking about how much money is going down the drain here every day, every week, every minute. I heard them earlier here. And the pressure is building in a different way. Do you know that chase that happened yesterday in D.C., that many of the officers who literally threw themselves at that situation, at that speeding car, were working without pay because of the shutdown?
You know, I don't think the shutdown scares people who hoard gold in bunkers and hate the bankers. In other words, I think that there's, we have on the extreme of the Republican Party, and not even the extreme, it's really much more toward the middle now of the Republican Party on right, you have this alliance, essentially a fusion of ideology of libertarian economics, a kind of paranoid version of libertarian economics and religious fundamentalism, both of which you would think would be somewhat contradictory, but they're not in terms of their attitude. And you have that combination is now the tail that's starting to wag the Republican dog. And the party has been consistently marginalizing, challenging within the party, and defeating anybody who has a hint of moderation. I mean, even Mitch McConnell has been, you know, being challenged, and others for being too far left. And so I think, you know, Boehner may not want the government to go into default. He may be incapable of preventing it.
Well, here's what this. I just want to read you this New York Times, actually Washington Post clip from an interview with a National Review journalist and a party broker. What we're seeing is the collapse of institutional Republican power. It's not about Boehner. It's things like the end of earmarks. They move away from Tom DeLay. They think they're improving the House, but now they have nothing to offer their members. The outside groups don't always move votes directly, but they create an atmosphere of fear among the members. So is this about a breakdown of an institution that allows individuals or groups to actually influence legislators through being able to raise money, threatening them with their districts?
Yeah, well, there's a large pack that's running ads against any, you know, against Republicans who don't want to repeal Obamacare or who are against the shutdown. So there is a stick being wielded, and they have seen moderate Republicans or even mainstream Republicans, whatever you want to call them, people with any modicum of common sense, be defeated in primary after primary. So they're not. I mean, fear is operative. They're also afraid of the consequences. They can see the polls. 70%, 59% of the people who don't, quote, like Obamacare, unquote, you know, don't like the shutdown.
Well, they don't.
And this is, I have to say, it is just so infuriating to hear these guys stand up and say that they're speaking for the American people when they're clearly not in any sense of the word.
So one thing here that's going on is there is sort of a soul searching going on for every member of the Republican House. What flavor of GOP am I? And even there's a little bit of distortion going on in the media, because one of the things I read this morning in the New York Times, if I may take a moment here, to say they described Dave Reichert's district as sort of moderate and swing. It was moderate and swing. Anybody take a look at the new maps? It is not moderate and or swing.
Well, let me come back to that, because let me pick up, Eli, I'll pick up with you, because we'll take a break. This is the Week in Review on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Tony's Coffee, a specialty coffee roaster providing sustainable sourced coffee. Available at Cafe Ladro and Java Bean Coffee. Locally roasted since 1971. More information at tonyscoffee.com.
It's 50 degrees in Seattle with some fog still hanging around, but it is beginning to lift. Forecast says we're going to wind up mostly sunny later this afternoon with a high today of 63. Similar pattern tomorrow. Morning fog, then mostly sunny, getting into the upper 60s. And on Sunday, same deal. Fog in the morning, sun in the afternoon, high temperatures in the 60s. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1020.
Any excuse to play Joe Strummer. And I just say, you know, if you want to get the honey, don't go killing all the bees, which is the lyric from that song, and perhaps appropriate to what we're talking about here. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Steve Scheer. We're here with Joni Balter. She's with the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Knut Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, and author of Pugetopolis. So Dave Reichert does not live anymore in a kind of a swing district, we assume. But Knut was saying, well, they're afraid. Are they afraid of losing their seats, or is this the larger fear for the Republicans of what's our party going to be like? They may have a lot of people in the House, but may not have any representation in the White House or in gubernatorial places. What were you thinking, Eli?
There's a way in which this is the Republicans' efforts at gerrymandering coming back to bite them. There are a lot of actually disparate Republican efforts that are coming back to bite them right now, but one of them is gerrymandering, which has created situations where you have about 80 members of the House who are Republicans, who are in extraordinarily safe districts. And so they're not afraid of any consequence of what they're doing right now. Their districts, for confusing reasons, support this. And so they can send the government into a shutdown, and they can threaten to send the U.S. into default. And people in their districts actually like that and want to see Obamacare defunded as a result, and are under the illusion that that is actually possible. So this is a huge problem for John Boehner, but it is not, like I was saying at the beginning of the show, an insurmountable problem, because he has a majority made up of Democrats and Republicans who are not from these districts that would vote to reopen the government tomorrow, or, as Obama said, in 5 minutes, if Boehner would just bring it to the floor. The problem is he's scared of losing his speakership because of the trouble that the 80 or so members who don't want him to do that could cause.
Sounds like, in the way people describe it, though, that the speakership is a much more powerless position.
Well, when you have 80 members of the House who are not worried about reelection, it's different. I've been doing some demographic research about relating back to the 2012 election. And, you know, a lot of the factors show that nationally the country is getting, has more diversity, and it has younger voters swinging things much more differently. And then what you have in these districts is you have actually whiter districts, older districts. And so this is this push-pull between the way these districts were drawn and actually the demographic trends of our country. And so that's one of the challenges here.
Well, this thing is that Americans, liberal and conservative, we all have a tendency to disconnect from reality from time to time and want something for nothing. But it's especially frustrating to watch. And I think Kathy McMorris Rogers in Eastern Washington, the congresswoman who represents Spokane and a lot of Eastern Washington, I mean, she is one of the kind of henchwomen of the shutdown, fully supportive of it, editorializing and whatnot, really taking a leadership position. And so you can say, well, her district is conservative. She represents, her district. Where would her district be without the federal government? Who gave the land for the railroads that cross eastern Washington? Who built I-90? Who built the dams? Who built who built Hanford? Who funded the reclamation projects that have turned eastern Washington into the breadbasket? You have a complete disconnect between the people who live there and the people they're voting for, and what the reality is on the ground, which is they are a creation of the federal government, and they are not acknowledging their responsibility in that. It's absolutely disgraceful.
On top of that is the disgrace of opposing a measure, Obamacare, that would help their constituents tremendously. These 80 Republicans, the New York Times pointed this out in an editorial today. A lot of the Republicans who want to shut down the government over Obamacare and are just vehemently opposed to it represent districts full of people, more full of people than the average district, that need a government expansion of health insurance.
Well, one of the interesting observations about the whole shutdown is that because the shutdown is so noisy and occupying so much of the news coverage, that these Republicans who have this agenda to hurt Obamacare or torpedo it in some way are missing the chance for the glitches in the system to become the number one story and to become the thing that everybody's talking about. Everybody's so obsessed with the shutdown that they're not hearing how the registering and the signing up for Obamacare is going. They could have, the lead story be, glitches in this many states. Instead, it's sort of pushed further down. And Paul Krugman in the New York Times argued this morning the other sort of side of this. One of the reasons this is happening now is, oh my gosh, what if people like Obamacare? What if their numbers come in lower? So there's this rush to kind of make it look bad right now. But in fact, we don't know this yet. People might find higher numbers for their own insurance in some states, and they might find lower numbers in other states. But what's not getting sort of the big push is the fact that if you go to these websites, you get yourself a fairly large headache.
Let me come back to that and Obamacare, but let me come back to that. To the question of the government shutdown. So what is it costing? About 300 OMB estimates it could be $300 million a day in lost economic output from the government. The argument that started all this, politics, Obamacare, but there is the argument that the government is still spending a lot more money than it's taking in, and it's not making a plan for what to do once the deficit spending, the reckoning for the deficit spending. Is that a legitimate argument?
Well, who agreed to discuss a grand bargain and was shut down on that? President Obama. I mean, the larger issue does need to be addressed and is not being addressed because of these guerrilla tactics. And, you know, I think it's so disingenuous, I think, to say that, you know, the shutdown is a reasonable tactic to get to a budget discussion that people have already agreed to get to. Jesus.
Skip. You're often upset.
He's a religious man all of a sudden.
This makes you more irate than I think I've heard you in many a day.
It does. It absolutely infuriates me because I think, I think it's the kind of thing where they are attempting to establish a precedent. Let's hope that it fails. Attempting to establish a precedent that will make government dysfunctional in perpetuity. It creates a precedent that makes it almost impossible to govern. And I think the Republicans, who are very free with saying they want a smaller government or no government or whatever, the old drown the baby in the bathtub argument about getting government that small, I think that, that their strategy is we're going to break it and show people that it's make everybody believe that it's broken, and it's sabotage. It's sabotage. It's that's exactly what it is.
It's also a refusal to accept the results of the democratic process. Obama has been reelected twice. The second time, it was, no one was unclear about how he felt about Obamacare. And so you could say that the last election was a referendum on Obamacare. Congress passed Obamacare. Congress has been unable to defund Obamacare by normal mechanisms like votes on the actual issue, not tying it to a shutdown. The Supreme Court has upheld Obamacare. So the democratic process has worked, and now a small minority, as Obama puts it, a minority of one party in one house of government or one house of Congress in one branch of government is trying to overturn the results of a Supreme Court decision, several elections, and congressional sessions of several years. That's not how our democracy is supposed to work.
Well, let's rewind to Monday night. And, remember watching that clock and, gosh, they've gone. So what if that didn't happen? What if they had reached some sort of agreement to these CRs you keep seeing, these continuing resolutions, only go for like 6 weeks? There was one idea for 1 week. But what if they had done the six-week one? Couldn't they at that time have sat down and had the very discussion you mentioned, Steve, about spending? Say, hey, we got here. We build on our success, I guess, if that's what that is called. You say, okay, so we're together for six more weeks. Let's get some of the issues out of the way so that we don't have another crisis on the debt ceiling. So, it's an interesting thing to think about which way it could have gone.
All right, let's turn to the healthcare plan and the glitches. Because, it was glitchy as we, wouldn't we have expected that first day? I suppose maybe I shouldn't have. But as you look, have you gone in and looked at the health plan? Have you done some different numbers in?
I tried.
You weren't able to?
No, I went in the first day several times.
Well, that's like going to a movie premiere. You're just never going to get in.
Yeah. But, it's one of those things where it was so frustrating. I just decided, okay, call me when it's really working, And frankly, talking to somebody on the phone about what your healthcare options is doesn't help. I'm a visual person. I want to see the actual plans laid out, And the state of Washington, they're doing their best. Great. I know they'll get it. Well, I don't know they'll get it sorted out. I hope they'll get it sorted out. But you would think, in a city that Jeff Bezos runs, you know, we could get, you know, a decent marketplace. You know, just have Amazon build it for you, for God's sake. You know, and I'm one of the people who needs to be on the individual market.
That's right.
Finding an insurance policy, and I want to compare it with the current, you know, ransom I pay to Group Health.
Well,
wow,
you know,
that's interesting.
It seems to me that a lot of people jumped on there. There's been pent-up demand. I think people were trying to see, you know, it's almost like this curiosity. So is it more? Is it less? How will I do? Will I be able to manage this in a better way? There was a figure I saw that the average wait was 1 minute and 13 seconds. So I started thinking, okay, does that sound like calling up, you know, Amazon, which you generally, you know, what is that similar to? Is that cable? Who are you calling? And you get that's not the worst amount of wait time. It, you know, if you put it on speaker and walk away and do the dishes, that whole bit.
The question is whether good products are showing up that people can use. Have you looked at it, Eli? Have you seen anything that was?
My sort of strategy in situations like this is to wait. I could see a kind of the word that is in my brain is one that I can't say on the air. A mess coming. You know, with more
Michigas.
Sure.
Let's hear it from Michigas.
With more people wanting to use these websites all at once than maybe the website was designed to handle, unfortunately. And so I'm just waiting, you know, a few weeks because you have until the end of the year to sort this out.
You have until March 31st to be exact.
Yeah.
To sign up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, under the plan that I'm on, I'm in the same boat as Skip. And so I need to look at the exchange also, but I've been waiting to do it. One thing that I'm interested in as a journalist is the question of how many people actually have successfully signed up. This is out there, this question, and so far the administration hasn't answered it. Presumably we'll get it in the next week or so. But it will be very, very instructive to see, despite the problems, how many people, you know, within the first week jumped on and said, yes, this is something I want. And it will begin to answer the question that Republicans have implicitly put forward as to whether anyone likes this program or not. I think we're going to see that the answer is yes, a lot of people do.
You know, I don't think there's any question the demand is going to be there because there's so many people. I know so many people, uninsured, insured. And, no, I have family members who struggle with this, you know, and one of the things about the marketplace I think people are looking forward to is is maybe just getting a better deal, like even, you know, getting even catastrophic coverage, but being able to get something that they can afford as opposed to having no options there. And everybody knows how difficult the individual market is. So I don't have any, you know, the demand is going to be there, and I think people will be coming in for that. And I think your analogy to kind of nobody. It's not a fair reviewer who goes to a restaurant and reviews it the first week, you know. So it is going to take run in. I know they're working hard. I hope they get it right and all that, and just have to be somewhat patient.
I just find I have been looking at it because I have been curious in putting in different numbers and seeing what comes up and different companies, Group Health, UW, but. And whether I'm a 25-year-old male making $30,000 a year or a 60-year-old female making $80,000, people are going to see how much healthcare costs. And anybody can now look and see how much their health insurance costs, I should say. And it may make it more popular. It will surely make people think about what they're paying for out of pocket. I mean, somebody like you is doing that all along. You're doing it.
I know what it costs.
But a lot of people don't. A lot of us don't because it just comes out of our taxes. And we could go along blissfully on that, but we will at least have a place to look that makes it sort of easy. And that's what I find so interesting.
I put up a post today on the Stranger's blog, Slog, about the freedom that Obamacare will provide to artists, or you could make the case for entrepreneurs also. There are a lot of people, and I think Knut was alluding to this, who are stuck in jobs that they don't want to be in, who have aspirations to do other things but stay with employment that is not good for them or is not fulfilling to them because they need health insurance. And so you hear all the time Republicans, a number of commenters pointed this out on Slog today. I thought it was a very good point. You hear a lot of times Republicans talking about Obamacare taking away our freedom. One of the major effects actually is going to be to give more freedom to people in the so-called creative class or people who want to be but are afraid of losing affordable insurance by taking a leap and jumping away from a job that they actually don't want to be in.
One of the most interesting things that I've been watching is how many people who don't like Obamacare have said it doesn't work, people hate it, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is we're just now signing up. So we don't know really, truthfully, how it affects any of us exactly. We don't know if we love it or hate it. It came up as just like, here's what we don't like. They don't like the idea of it. There has been fear surrounding this bill since it was first mentioned because it was so big. It was 2,400 pages, if that's the right amount. And if you talk to people, they'd say, I don't like it. And you'd push a little further. What don't you like? I don't know. It's too big. And then there would be all these myths. And so one of the things that's going on here is it's actually coming in, and people are making these phone calls and making these calculations. So I think the jury's still out on this, right? We don't know. You don't know if you're higher or lower. Once you find that out, you'll decide if the coverage is better.
And then perhaps we'll see the kinds of reforms that need to take place in this mishigas to what people have alluded to.
Well, and I think one thing that's happening with the healthcare is that it's getting all the baggage of everything that any company or the healthcare system itself has done unrelated, but they're blaming the healthcare. You know, so people say, well, the premiums are going up. Well, they haven't been going up without Obamacare. They've been going up ridiculously. It's amazing. So is Obamacare going to cure all of that? No, it's not. You have companies that are laying part-time workers off, blaming it on Obamacare, and other companies that say that's preposterous. It's become this convenient thing. There are also a lot of people who don't like Obamacare because they want to see single payer. I mean, living in Seattle, we know a lot of those, people.
Some of them are named Jim McDermott, aren't they?
Well, and I have a lot of friends that I've talked about. You know, how do you feel about Obamacare? And they're like, well, you know, I'm looking forward to signing up, but it's not single payer. You know, it's not really solving the problem.
Let me take a break, and when we come back, let's switch to local politics and let's take a look at what's happening in the mayor's race. We are reviewing the week with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter on KUOW.
KUOW and Theater Puget Sound present Arts Crush, 31 days of creative adventures in October with interactive opportunities in theater, dance, literature, music, and visual arts across Puget Sound for people of all ages. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
This bar in Berlin takes digital currency, bitcoins, the same untraceable money used by gunrunners and drug lords. Many legit businesses use bitcoins. For them, it's like money in the bank, without the bank.
We don't need physical transfer of money anymore, so in our mind, banks are kind of useless.
Using bitcoins in Berlin, next time on The World.
You'll hear that later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which begins at 3 p.m. 50 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 63, and the forecast says it's going to wind up mostly sunny. It's 10:40.
You're listening to KUOW Seattle, The Week in Review with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger. I'm Steve Scher. You may have noticed we don't have an email address yet for you to send in email comments to us because we have to figure that out. I was going to use "and another thing," but Marcy Silman's got that for her blog. Jason was thinking perhaps gasbag at KUOW.org.
Is that a personal thing for Jason?
Yeah, that's personal. No, we're going to come up with one because we want to hear from you. We also do want to know if you have tried to get into these exchanges, what success you've had, what you're learning, and that's part of our record feedback that we're going to ask you to give us. 206-221-3663. Have you used these exchanges? Are they working for you? Have they failed for you? What are you finding there? 206-221-3663. We're going to hear your reactions later on the record. So, Joni and Skip attended a TV shooting, a civic cocktail, and I went there and watched it, Knute.
And it was a small gathering at this show.
One of the questions that you raised, Joni, was where's the excitement for this mayor's race? People seem to be kind of, I don't know, quiet about it. And
I was just asking, is it under the radar? Is this a race that has so much to do with the sort of political chattering folks being really into the race? And then is it under the radar? Because it is a different kind of race. Has anybody seen very many yard signs? Has anybody seen very many TV ads yet so far? I really haven't. Now, I know they start like any minute or something like that.
You'll be bemoaning them.
It just feels like it's strategically a little bit of a different race. It's event-driven. It's Twitter-driven. It just has a different feel to me, and I don't know if the general public's really paying that much attention. I mean, we talk about it, but
yeah. Well, that's interesting you say about event-driven, because day before yesterday there was a press conference from some Ed Murray supporters, club owners, saying, well, some of us don't support McGinn. We did last time. Now we're with Murray. Murray yesterday had a vision speech. What are you learning? What are you learning from his vision, and what are you learning from this race?
Well, I don't think this race is much about vision. It's not that the candidates don't have some different emphasis on issues, but you know, ideologically they're really the same. And I have a piece on Crosscut this morning talking about the sort of dullness of the race and what it really is sort of a race. I see it as between two aspects of Seattle personality. In the vision talk yesterday by Ed Murray, it was a perfectly fine speech, but it wasn't really a vision speech. It was really emphasizing that, you know, McGinn is divisive and I'm Mr. Togetherness. I mean, he had 26 times used the word together or togetherness in a 15-minute talk. I mean, it had more together stuff than a Jesse Colin Young song. You know? I mean, it was all about. And he laid out, you know, his you know, what he wants to do on education, but it was really almost all about process. Was really almost all about, we're going to get together, build a coalition, we're going to get this done, we're going to do that. Seattle's an innovative town, we're going to promote business. I mean, you've heard it over and over again, not just from these mayoral candidates, but from other ones. So it's become this kind of stylistic race between the kind of, you know, Mayor Wedge, Mike McGinn, you know, somebody who's, you know, will go after an issue and really hammer home. I think the way the race is playing out is partly because Ed Murray has a big lead and he's trying to ride that out without jeopardizing his position.
Ed Murray has a big lead in polls you've seen?
In the one major poll that we've seen, and you hear it from people in terms of private polls and stuff. He appears to have a significant lead, and I think he's trying to run a campaign where he's wants to really remind people, I am not Mike McGinn, I am not Mike McGinn, I am not Mike McGinn, and let McGinn's negatives. Now, the tactic between the two of them is Murray is the not Mike McGinn guy who's got all of Seattle's values and plus gay marriage. And McGinn is the global warming, most progressive you guy. But he is poking and poking at Murray. He wants Murray to lose his cool. He wants Murray to show himself as not the Mr. Together guy, but somebody who has failed in Olympia and who probably has a thin skin. He's poking at Murray, and the danger, of course, in that whole thing is that in poking him, he will reinforce one of his big negatives, which is that he is seen as a divisive guy. And that happened with this race accusation that was made last week.
The accusation that Ed Murray wasn't sensitive to a...
Yeah, that he wasn't for affirmative action, yeah. And had been saying one thing behind the scenes
on I-200,
which was debunked by the guy who is a McGinn supporter of all things. But I think that racial issue was definitely a very, very sensitive sore spot.
And what maybe a sign that the McGinn campaign is feeling the heat of the poll numbers. We've only really had one public poll as far as I can tell, and I would really like to see another one just to see if the 20-point lead that Murray had in that poll is continued, I think we'd get a different and more interesting race if we could have more polling and maybe see that the race is closer. I don't know if polling will actually show that. But to go there on the racial issue, I think it is a sign that McGinn is feeling pressure and feeling behind. And as it played out, it seemed like it actually didn't go anywhere substantive. So it was a little unfortunate. I agree that the race has become basically about disposition. And to the extent that people aren't engaged, it might be because we've been in an extended civic debate about McGinn's disposition for 4 years. People have been talking about it ever since he took office. And so people have really solidified in their opinions about McGinn, whether they like him or they don't, and they did that quite a while ago, most likely. Similarly with Ed Murray, he's been around for a long time. Now, the entire city doesn't know him because he hasn't represented the entire city, but a lot of people here have pretty settled views of Ed Murray and his disposition and what they think of it. And so if the two candidates are going back and forth trying to shift impressions of the other's disposition, I don't know how far you get with that, and it certainly is not incredibly engaging to people outside the universe of political wonks. I find it really interesting. I'm just not sure the city does.
Well, the polling on that one poll that we all have that shows it a 22-point advantage for Ed Murray, that poll, that doesn't work.
The
King 5 poll, and the reason it doesn't work is it had 10%. We talked about this once before. It had 10% cell phone voters. The average in a city like Seattle is going to be way higher, and there's a lot of those cell phone only, they call them, voters who were not captured in this poll, who are younger and therefore tend to be sort of McGinn supporters. The race has sort of boiled down. I've been watching it since before the actual primary vote. I've been trying to figure out what is this race really about. And I imagined Murray's handler saying to him, just go up there and don't say anything scary. Don't say anything that upsets people. Seattle voters are very forgiving. They will let mayors do things that aggravate them, that they don't agree with, as long as you don't sort of throw them off and make them mad. And so, as Skip was saying, and I would add to that, Murray has been saying, I'm not McGinn, I'm not divisive, I have ideas, I know people in Olympia, and I don't fight my way. I don't get up in the morning and start fighting. That seems to be the message.
Well, and one of the things that he was emphasizing this week is the range of support that he has. So you've got
Murray.
Yes. So you've got the Chamber of Commerce backs Murray. But as he was pointing out, he's got a bunch of SEIU locals. And it's sort of like you would think that McGinn would have completely locked down the club folks.
The club thing was a big deal.
And I think, it says a lot that people like Dave Minert and others who are huge supporters of McGinn have flipped and gone to Murray. I think that Joni's right about the poll, but we can guess if it's a 10-point difference, it's still a significant difference. But I think that, and I don't think Murray's being complacent about the fact that he's going to need to turn out his voters. I think the campaign, of course, it's the last month. We've got, 32 days, 31 days, something like that to go. And one thing that's changed, and this showed up in the primary, is that campaign tactics have changed in Seattle. What is effective is having a whole lot of money to dump into telephone banks. And that trumps signs, that trumps a whole lot of things. You have to have the volunteers and you have to have the paid people to run that kind of thing. And that is a campaign that really starts to ratchet up once the ballots drop. And so I think there's a lot of this just feels like a continuation of primary stuff. It hasn't really kicked in.
Do you need to have the money to have people going door to door to assure that ballots are mailed, or is it enough to be making the phone calls? What's been the strategy on that?
It absolutely has to be both. And I will just note here that I got my first phone call last night from my daughter, who really does need to cancel her Washington voter registration. And it was
just
from
a shout out on that.
I mean, just a shout out. Would you hurry up? No, okay. But the Murray people calling. And there has been quite a discussion here about how tactically advantaged McGinn is. He knows his campaign knows how to get out the vote. It is very sophisticated. But here was the first phone call to my house looking for my daughter who won't cancel her King County voter registration.
Well, that's interesting that that's the case, because that's how Mike McGinn is given credit for winning last time, because he had a very strong ground campaign.
Which was helped by a huge influx of volunteers, younger people who got excited about McGinn's campaign, kind of as an echo of the Obama campaign. And the question is whether he will have anything close to that this time around, whether enthusiasm for him among people, grassroots supporters who will show up for free at those phone banks, is still there. Some of it is clearly still there, but whether it is on the level that it was last time around.
We are reviewing the week with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger. All right, we're gonna wrap it up by bringing one more person in and shifting gears just a little bit. Luke Burbank. Luke, how could I introduce Luke? You know, Luke used to be an intern here at KUOW, but he's blown up. Luke Burbank, TBTL, Too Beautiful to Live. You blew up, Luke, and I'm sorry that happened to you. Worked for
I'm okay now. It was a long hospitalization after the blowing up, but I'm back to about 90% of my original self, so that's good.
He is now host of Live Wire. You can hear it on KUOW tonight at 8. It's a variety show, a comedy show, music show. But we were thinking about football a little bit, Luke, and you're a little unsure about sports in this town. What, we have a winning team and you're not so sure you're comfortable with that?
Yeah, you know, you guys have been talking about a lot of real issues, the mayoral race and other things, but let's get down to what is actually on everyone's minds. Even people who previously have not been sports fans, is the fact that we have, between the UW Huskies and the Seattle Seahawks, two undefeated football teams in this town. And as a long, long-suffering football fan, I'm not emotionally prepared for the reality that is winning teams. I don't know what to do with myself. It's like everything I think I know about being a Seattle sports fan has been turned on its head.
You know, Stanford might be able to help you this weekend.
Yeah, Joni, I do think that a hard rain is going to fall on the Huskies and very possibly on the Seahawks, because they have to go to Indianapolis and play a really good team there. But, you know, I mean, I am a kid who, I grew up in Seattle. My dad was a pastor, and he would be giving these sermons on Sunday, and I would sneak out the back of the church and go into our family's Dodge Dart and listen to Pete Gross call the Seahawks games as a little kid, and it was just one loss after another, and that's what I've been trained to expect. So I'm afraid of success. I don't know what to do with success. I'm out of my depth here.
No, you got to embrace it. Now that's you too, right, Knut?
You're into embracing.
You're talking about Richard Sherman now. He's NFC Defensive Player of the Month. The guys, you have people you can look to as football players and say, wow, that's a great player.
Yeah, it is, and that hasn't happened on the football side in a long time in the same way.
The good news is that the Mariners are still disappointing.
They're helping. Right.
Yeah,
they actually had a promo towards the end of this season where if you were one of the first 9 people at Safeco, you got to play, which is one of the few games they won, actually.
Well,
just 4 innings.
Well, what about the Sports Illustrated curse when they put our guys on the cover? Doesn't that play out?
Well, I'm sure it will play a role towards the end of the season when we are losing, and I'm blaming it on that. Remember, we had this guy, Sean Alexander, who was a really great running back for the Seahawks, and then they put him on the cover of the video game. I think it might have been Madden.
Yeah, it was the Madden game.
And then he, I mean, like, literally couldn't run through a defensive line of schoolgirls. So, I mean, I'm assuming that everything good that happens is just setting up a heartbreaking jinx
you
for
guys.
Later.
Yeah, well, that is the Scandahoovian way for sure.
You guys should just go be a Chicago Cubs fan. Hey, Luke, you're going to eat something on stage at Livewire tonight called crack pie. That doesn't seem
so
legal.
I know, it's a dessert. The good news is it's a dessert, guys. I know it sounds a little dicey for public radio, but we record, the way this Livewire show works is we record it in Portland in front of a big crowd, and then we play it the following Saturday night, so I already know what people are going to be hearing tonight on KUOW at 8 p.m.
Wow, you're like in the future.
It's amazing. I've traveled here from a future where the Seahawks have totally imploded back to this Friday to tell you guys about Livewire tonight. So, yeah, we have a few different guests. We have this guy, Jonathan Colton, who's a really funny singer. We have this woman, Molly Crabapple, who went to Guantanamo Bay, but she's actually a graphic artist, and she basically kind of did these sketches of the people and the things going on in Guantanamo Bay, which was pretty fascinating. And then last but not least, we have a woman named Christina Tozzi who runs a place called Momofuku Milk Bar in Brooklyn, which is kind of the dessert headquarters now for the food movement. And she brought something called crack pie, which we ate on stage and then smoked a little of it in the alley later after the show. And it was incredible.
Either way, it was good.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, watch both games, and we'll see how you feel about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they just may win
next week.
Yeah, full report. And, you know, if you have any more crack pie, let us know.
I'm saving a little just to try to help assuage the pain after the Stanford Cardinal destroy my beloved Huskies.
Oh, it's not going to happen. Luke Burbank is the host of Live Wire. You can hear it on KUW tonight at 8. Luke, I hope we talk to you again.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
See ya.
So speaking of winning and losing and being a member of this fair city, are you excited about the R, the Rainier R, coming back up into public
view? Yeah.
Even though it's a duplicate, but.
Well, yeah, it's Seattle has all kinds of historic structures that are reproductions. Did you know that? The pergola is not the original pergola.
Well, it's been hit so many darn times.
That's right. The totem pole isn't the original totem pole that was there either. I mean, we have, you know, have all these kind of fake monuments around. And, yeah, so they took down the Tully's T, which was just a weird, nobody ever got used to that thing.
Yeah,
and the company's now putting a Rainier Beer R back up there, and it's a reproduction because the original is in the Mohai.
Eli was hoping to go get some Rainier Beer down there, but that's not happening, you know.
Well, that's what I was wondering. There's no Rainier Beer actually made there anymore.
It's not made there, no, because they've turned it into lofts or something. But the
so there is a lot of Rainier Beer.
No, but
there.
but in the bars there is. You can get your tall boys. You know, you can get your Rainiers and. And I know that in association with putting this thing up, they're having like a Rainier Beer pub crawl and a big party and all kinds of stuff. So that's coming up in a week or two.
Any excuse for a pub crawl?
Yeah.
Any excuse for a pub crawl? Should we end on that note?
Well, you got to get your vitamin R.
The pub crawl should end in crack pie. That would be a good pub crawl.
Wash down.
Oh, my gosh. All right. It's great to be back.
First week back and you're
pub crawls
total,
and crack
total
pie.
Control.
Joni Balter is with the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Knut Berger is author of Pugetopolis. He writes at Crosscut and Seattle Magazine, right? As well.
Yes. That's
and we heard from Luke Burbank, who rejoins the public radio fold, host of Live Wire. Jason Pagano's putting the show together. Here we'll go out with a little Jonathan Colton. Talk to you next week.
Face with the Oakland booty. I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. Your pretty picture. My homeboys tried to.